are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, February 15th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, 17 dead, 15 injured in a Florida high school mass shooting. Then we will talk to Daniel Marins on what a battle over Virginia's most powerful monopoly can teach Democrats everywhere. Meanwhile, Trump determined to quash the immigration deal, and the Department of Homeland Security complains that the Senate legislation is too humane. Meanwhile, Washington State, the death penalty on the brink of being outlawed. Revelation, more than 130 White House officials lack permanent security clearance. New York Times employees apparently don't like Barry Weiss. And Jared Kushner investors now subpoenaed. All this and more on today's Majority Report. So, folks, we will get to Daniel Marins a little bit later than typically, as our format allows. Obviously, horrible, just heartbreaking and enraging news out of Parkland, Florida. I am sure most of you know the as much as we do, if not more. But a student who had been expelled from Parkland High came back. I guess he was 19 years old. He purchased in Florida an AR-15 weapon. Because in Florida, if you're over the age of 18, you can't buy a beer legally, but you can go in and get a weapon with virtually nothing to prevent you from buying it, short of having some cash. Apparently, this kid was adopted. His father died about a decade ago. His mother died more recently. He was living with friends, a family. I guess he had his own room. He was going to a different school than the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, in which he shot 17 people dead. He's alive, which is a fairly unique situation for this type of mass slaughter. So we may have a little bit more insight as to why he did it. At the end of the day, I'm not sure that that's really relevant anymore. I mean, there was a time where there was some relevance to why did this person do this? And I would imagine maybe for the victims' families and the victims themselves, that explanation might bring a tiny amount of closure. But in terms of a society, it's really wholly irrelevant now. I mean, when these type of mass killings, and we don't have one like this. We haven't seen one like this size. I mean, obviously, there was one in Las Vegas, but we haven't seen a mass killing of this size perpetrated by someone who does it in the name of some type of international terrorist organization. In those instances, the why matters, because then we can express it through Islamophobia. I'm speaking society-wide. But when it's just a white guy, just an American who does this, then it's just, it's really inappropriate to even question on some level, right? We're not even supposed to talk about how he managed to do it. And every time, people who've listened to this program for an extended period of time know that, seemed like every week that Cliff Schechter would come on at the time that he was working for a couple organizations that were fighting gun violence. You know, that every week we would recount the latest. Now it just seems useless. There is a lot more fervor on the pro everybody can have a AR-15 side. And one of the things that I keep saying over and over again in these situations is, like, you know, I want to know who manufactured this gun. Now, for some reason, it doesn't seem to be any reporting about that. All the big gun manufacturers have their version of an AR-15. But I want to know who specifically did this one. I want to be able to send the CEO a card saying, congratulations on your weapon doing such a good job at shredding these high school students. Congratulations on your weapon doing such a good job in killing that toddler. Congratulations on your weapon being able to rip apart the vital organs of that football coach at the high school, of that sociology teacher. I'd like to be able to send a card to the members of the board of directors of that company and just compliment them. Compliment them on the quality of their product that so effectively, you know, 19-year-old kid, don't know how much training he had with that AR-15, probably took it to some shooting ranges, but I mean, how much training could he have had? Hundreds of hours? No, it is the efficacy of that gun that allowed him to kill so many people, injure so many people. And I really think that the men, and I imagine they're men, maybe there's a woman in there, who are responsible for manufacturing that weapon, really deserve a kudos, because that thing did exactly what they manufactured it to do. It ripped apart the human flesh and organs of all those high school kids with an efficiency. I mean, how long did it take them to do that? A couple of minutes? That's great. That's a very well-made product, and they deserve to have, I mean, at the very least, some recognition for the great job they're doing in providing that product. But yet, for some reason, I don't know if reporters don't ask this question of the police. I don't know why the police would have any type of policy. We don't give out the manufacturer of the AR-15. You don't hear police when there's a car accident or someone rams a car into people. They don't say, well, we're just going to say it was a coupe. We're not going to tell you what make of the car. I want to know the make. I want to know the man
who was responsible for looking over the Q, where are we now? The Q1 numbers for 2018, and know that when that guy goes home with the hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars he's going to make just in Q1, that part of it was from making such a good weapon that it was able to tear through the flesh and the organs of those high school students who thought they were just going to school on Valentine's Day. Right? I mean, that's...
That guy will probably make more money if this follows past trends. Gun sales often go up after a mass shooting because people are afraid that the government will enact some kind of gun control measures.
Indeed, they do.
But I don't think they need to worry at this point in time.
All right, let's go. Let's listen to a little bit of video. I don't know what to say when we talk about this stuff at this point, really. But here is an 18-year-old student at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. He's being interviewed by Allison Camerota. I mean, and he makes this point, but it's an embarrassment that this country has to rely on a teenager who is probably going to be traumatized for the rest of his life, probably has no idea of just how traumatized he's going to be at this point, be some type of voice of reason. This is a kid named David Hogg.
Something has gone terribly wrong when all of us adults are looking to you 14 and 18-year-olds for wisdom and to help us figure out how to solve this. But that's where we are today. And so, Kelsey,
Let's just make it clear. There's no figuring out here. This is not a puzzle. There's no mystery here. And every time any adult says that, like, we need to figure this out, they're hiding. This is just a question of will. This couldn't be any more straightforward.
Continue. To solve this, but that's where we are today. And so, Kelsey, I don't understand. How are you as a freshman going to move on? What's going to happen when you go back to school?
I don't know, but hopefully I can push through and make the remainder of this year worth it, because freshman year is supposed to be fun and exciting, but unfortunately us freshmen this year and sophomores had to go through this, and seniors and juniors, everybody had to go through this, teachers. I believe this was Mr. Beagle's first year in school at this school, and he is no longer going to be teaching here because of this insane man.
Are you going to be able to go back into this building behind us?
Yes. I'm not going to let this person stop me. That's what they want to do. They want to scare us. They want to make us feel unsafe. And I say no. I take a stance on my personal, in my own personal way, to say that's not okay. I don't feel afraid. I'm going to continue learning so I can prevent this from happening again. And that's what you guys as journalists are doing as well. And the fact that you're reporting on this says so much. But what we really need is action. Because we can say, yes, we're going to do all these things, thoughts and prayers. What we need more than that is action. Please, this is the 18th one this year. That's unacceptable. We're children. You guys are the adults. You need to take some action and play a role. Work together, come over your politics, and get something done.
Yeah.
I mean, kids in a state of shock, still correct. It's pathetic. It's pathetic.
Let's listen to this pathetic scumbag who juxtaposed, it's on Fox News here, images of people crying. And here is Ted Cruz. And Well, let me just read this piece before we do this. I'm just going to read this little piece. Matt had pointed this out. Let's see if I've got this somewhere. Yeah, it's from a piece by Gary Wills. Wrote it in the New York Review of Books. He wrote this in 2012, post Newtown. When all those elementary school kids were shot up by the AR-15. It's entitled Our Moloch. This is a god referred to in the Bible and other places, I guess. Just a couple of passages. Devotion to it precludes interruption with the sacrifices it entails. Like most gods, it does what it will and cannot be questioned. It's referring to guns. Its acolytes think it's capable only of good things. It guarantees life and safety and freedom. It even guarantees law. Law grows from it. Then how can law question it? Its power to do good is matched by its incapacity to do anything wrong. It cannot kill. Thwarting the god is what kills. If it seems to kill, that's only because the god's bottomless appetite for death has not been adequately fed. The answer to problem caused by guns is more guns. Millions of guns, guns everywhere, carried openly, carried secretly, in bars, in churches, in offices, in government buildings. Only the lack of guns can be a curse. It is not the time to question Moloch. No time is right for showing disrespect to Moloch. It has the power to destroy the reasoning process. It forbids making logical connections. We're required to deny there's any connection between the fact that we have the greatest number of guns in private hands and the greatest number of deaths from them. Denial on this scale always comes from or is protected by religious fundamentalism. It has the power to turn all our politicians as a class into invertebrate and mute attendants at the shrine. None dare suggest that Moloch can in any way be reined in without being denounced by the Pope of this religion, the National Rifle Association CEO Wayne LaPierre. They whimper and they say they never entertain such heresy. Many flourish their guns while campaigning or boast that they have themselves hunted varmints. Better that than the children die or their lives be blasted than a politician should risk an election against the dread sentence of NRA excommunication. I mean, there's more to it. But let's hear Ted Cruz praise Moloch.
What his motives were, but whatever they were evil, and this is a horrible, horrible thing, and our prayers are very much with us, Florida families.
Could something like that happen in Texas? Do they have armed guards in public schools in Texas?
Sure, this could happen anywhere. I mean, we have seen that evil can occur, whether in Parkland or in a church in central Texas or in schools across the country. I mean, there are murderers. Evil is sadly always present, and we need to do what we can to act to prevent it. Sometimes you see brave heroes who are able to step forward, and sometimes you have people like in Sutherland Springs who are armed, who can engage the killer and stop them and save people's
lives.
Well,
that's what I was saying. Do your public schools allow it? Because I know every state is different. Do your public schools allow armed security?
Oh, sure. There are certainly some schools that have armed security, and that can make a difference, but it varies school by school.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's talk around this whole thing. Let's talk about evil. Let's even just bank shot the fact that we've all been told right after Newtown, the idea was the gym teacher will have a gun in his locker. That's the way we're going to stop this. Gym teacher will have a gun in his locker and they'll stop it. Well, there were two cops at this school. There were two cops at this school. In Florida, there are cops in the school, right? This is not a soft target. So we're not going to hear that. We'll wait until the next one. If it takes place at a movie theater or at a school without a cop, to hear about, well, the problem is a soft target. You need to have the guy selling popcorn. He needs to have a gun. Or the gym teacher again. We'll go back to the gym teacher having a gun. Or what about maybe arming the kids? Maybe if you're 18, we'll do that thing like when we were kids, you apply to be the crossing guard. And you carry like that little orange, you know, belt that you put around your shirt. So you could actually be like help with the crossing guards. We'll just do that with the kids. Because if there were kids, if there were like 10 kids per classroom armed, maybe with their own semi-automatics, chances are that would have helped. Now, the killer in this instance used smoke bombs. But maybe if we give the kids gas masks too, so we give them semi-automatic weapons, gas masks, maybe that would do it. But here is the superintendent of Broward County Public Schools making it clear that even non-soft targets are able to be ripped to shreds by this AR-15, the wonderful product that some CEO oversees the manufacture of.
Well, afternoon, what police presence and security presence is on?
Every high school in this county has police presence at the high school. So there were officers on the school site at all times.
Do you know for certain how many or where?
There typically are at least two cars of law enforcement individuals on our campuses on a daily basis.
Resource officers, are they called?
They're called school resource officers. That is correct.
Superintendent.
Yeah, there you go. So, unfortunately, we won't have the opportunity to hear from people who are going to talk about this being a soft target. They're just going to have to wait until the next one. They'll wait till the next one. So, Chris Murphy, who has more than typical investment in this issue of guns because of Sandy Hook Elementary School, which was shot up in Connecticut. He took to the floor and almost immediately and committed heresy, actually talked about what enabled. So if we are to believe Ted Cruz, evil's everywhere. Evil's everywhere, and we never know when it's going to strike, and there's really nothing we can do about it. You can put a couple of cops in the school, but you can't stop evil, because evil can mutate. It can take different forms. Sometimes it's a solid, and sometimes it's a gas. So you can't capture evil. It's just going to go right through your fingers. And Chris Murphy then committed heresy on the floor of the Senate by actually talking about what we could practically do to inhibit evil's ability to wrap its tentacles or whatever it is around the instrument in which it was able to kill 17 people at a high school.
Turn on your television right now. You're going to see scenes of children running for their lives. What looks to be the 19th school shooting in this country, and we have not even hit March. I'm coming to the floor to talk about something else, but let me just note once again for my colleagues that this happens nowhere else other than the United States of America. This epidemic of mass slaughter, this scourge of school shooting after school shooting. It only happens here not because of coincidence, not because of bad luck, but as a consequence of our inaction. We are responsible for a level of mass atrocity that happens in this country with zero parallel anywhere else. As a parent, it scares me to death that this body doesn't take seriously the safety of my children. And it seems like a lot of parents in South Florida are going to be asking that same question later today. We pray for the families, for the victims. We hope for the best.
And then let's just wrap this up with Marco Rubio showed up on Fox News. And I got a list here of who gets the most money from the NRA. And some people get a decent amount of money from the NRA. And then what they also do is they get a ton of money that is spent via the NRA against its opponent. So for a guy like John McCain, for instance, he only gets $37,000 worth of direct support from the NRA, about another $500,000 of NRA independent support. In other words, they didn't give directly to the campaign. They just did, ads on his behalf. But then they spent $7 million against his opponent in the last, this is the last round of elections. Now, Marco Rubio, he doesn't get that type of John McCain cash. He only got about $5,000 of direct support from the NRA, $1 million of outside independent support, and then only about $2.7 million, or I should say $2.3 million of ads to attack his opponent. And here he is. He doesn't want to rush to any conclusions on this. This is really complicated stuff, folks, because there's a nuance. Like, for instance, in Sandy Hook, when that guy came in there with the AR-15, he was shooting elementary school kids. And so the angle of the shooting was probably different than in this instance when the guy came in with an AR-15 and was shooting high school kids. So the trajectory of the bullets were probably more at more parallel to the ground, as opposed to sort of like on a 30-degree angle. And of course, this is very different from the full-on machine guns that were used in Las Vegas. So all this stuff, this is very complicated stuff. So he wants to make sure that we all have all the facts before we make any type of conclusions on this.
Your colleagues in the Senate here from Washington, D.C. have already been trying to make this about policy and about gun control. Is this the appropriate time to be doing that?
It's not only because people don't, they don't know how this happened. I mean, who this person is, what motivated them, how did they get a hold of the weapon that they used for this attack? I think it's important to know all of that before you jump to conclusions that there's
pause
some...
it. What difference does it make who this person is? What possible difference could it make?
Well, if they're a Muslim, then they can blame it on that.
Yeah.
Or if it's an illegal immigrant.
That's right. I guess
then we
that's,
can make Kate's law.
Then we can make Steinle. It about right. Then we can make it about Kate's law.
Important to know all of that before you jump to conclusions that there's some law that we could have passed that could have prevented it, and there may be. But shouldn't we at least know the facts? And so, I think that you can always have that debate. But if you're going to have the debate about this particular incident, you should know the facts of that incident before you run out and prescribe some law that you claim could have prevented it. I've seen a lot of that on television, and maybe there is a law that could have prevented this instance. But we don't know that, and neither do they.
Yeah, we don't know that, neither. And now, my understanding is he was heading down to Florida, right, to deal with that, which I think is incredibly irresponsible. We don't know the facts. What if this guy was not just a student who had been expelled and come back? What if he was the tip of the spear of an invasion by Cuba? that they were coming up the Gulf Coast. How do we know this isn't a roving band of MS-13 gang members who are taking all over a parkland, and you're going to have a senator go down there? We need to know the facts before he does anything. I mean, should we even be sending the cops into this situation? Don't we need to know more about what's going on? Maybe we need the military to go in. Maybe we need a special team of ninjas to go in, but yet we just send the cops without any facts. Why are we responding to this without knowing the facts? All we know are that there are children screaming and being shot, but we don't know anything else. We can't. I mean, this is plenty of time, folks, to deal with this. Marco Rubio, that bastion, right? Isn't he the brave leader? Isn't that's his big brand, right? Like he was, he took on immigration, then he backed out of that, right?
Yeah, not anymore.
Not anymore. Little Marco.
Needs a drink of water.
It's probably too soon to have any kind of criticism of any left response to this, but I hope that liberals will think about how awful these deaths were the next time they're thinking about supporting violence and death overseas through military interventionism and policies that have caused many, many more deaths than any single mass shooting in America. I'm not saying that you're doing that, Sam. I know you're very much care about all of these issues, but I do see a certain level of hypocrisy in some liberals.
That's true. That's true. All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to change gears. We had planned this interview. I didn't want to. We're going to talk to Daniel Marins over what a battle in Virginia. This is going to be our last live show for the next week or so. Wanted to fit this in. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more.
Time told me who's to go.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Politics reporter for HuffPost, Daniel Marins, on what a battle over Virginia's most powerful monopoly can teach Democrats everywhere. Daniel, welcome to the program.
It's great to be here, Sam.
So now I should say that you wrote this piece that I'm referencing on, I guess it was, it came out on Monday, the 12th, and you wrote it without knowing what the outcome of this battle actually was. And you presupposed it was one that the lesson would be, you know, next time Democrats should really do something about this on some level, or there was an attempt to. And they ended up surprising both you and I. But let's talk about what was this battle about in Virginia?
Right. So I think in just about every state, there are one or several major public utilities, and they're basically given an exemption from antitrust laws. In other words, they don't have to compete for their customer base. The folks that sell you your electricity, the vast majority of the time, do not have a choice in that matter. And the thinking on that is that in order to maintain a vast infrastructure of power lines, and in some cases, the power plants themselves, it's very hard to be profitable and competitive and be competing for customers at the same time. And given that electric power is such a fundamental element of living in the modern world, governments don't really want to take a gamble with that. Now, there was an experiment with some deregulation, and that gets into Enron and what they were trying to do there, but it didn't work out that well. And so it's now mostly back to regulated monopolies. And what that means is because they're not competing for customers, there's no real check on the prices unless the government regulates those utility rates, the rates that it charges that captive customer base. And in most states in the country, these utilities are powerful, but there's some balance, and the state governments basically allow regulators to do their thing. In Virginia, there are two huge utility monopolies, one of which is bigger than the other, and that's Dominion Energy. And Dominion is a vertically integrated company that has nuclear plants and natural gas wells, and it sells electricity in more than one state, but really provides electric power to more than two-thirds of the residential homes and business customers in Virginia. And Virginia is also a state where there are limitless campaign contributions, literally no limits. It's one of a handful of states like that. And so you have a situation where the legislature that's regulating this enormous utility monopoly has steadily over the past few decades become, I think, objectively more and more beholden to them, more and more captive to their interests, to the point where in 2015, they essentially passed a law saying,
now, Daniel, hold on.
Let
me stop you before we get to that 2015, because I just want to understand a little bit more about how this dynamic came about. If there's something unique about Virginia, I mean, I imagine one of the elements is that the complete lack of restrictions on campaign finance. But is there also something else unique about Virginia that an energy company could become so dominant?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think, first of all, you have the fact that historically in Virginia, both parties are pro-business, going back a long time. And there was a populist movement in Virginia in the 70s, led by a guy named nicknamed Howland Henry Howell, who was an attorney from Southeast Virginia, who led an interracial sort of working class little guy against the big guy coalition to become lieutenant governor in the 70s, and then tried unsuccessfully to be governor in the late 70s. But really, you know, going back to, if you think Mark Warner was governor of Virginia. Tim Kaine was governor of Virginia. And of course, they're all governors for one term. These are folks, and those are Democrats that really govern from a pro-business consensus that is extremely embedded in the state. And so that's one component of it. And the other thing is that Virginia, like many states, in fact, I think most, has a part-time legislature. And so you're then dealing with a three-month window to basically deal with this whole array of issues, whether it's abortion, minimum wage, and things like utility rates. And so that creates a vacuum where staffs are not huge, they're not well-funded. These are not necessarily people that these are often people that by definition have to be affluent in order to be able to afford to serve in the legislature. And so you have this element of a monopoly on information as well, as one person put it to me, and that you basically have these incredibly complex pieces of utility rate legislation that the vast majority of lawmakers don't understand. And that makes it really easy for a utility company to come in and say, oh, here's the deal, here's what you need to do. And by the way, if you don't do this, you're probably not going to get your electric power lines underground. You're probably not going to meet your renewable targets. And believe us, you know, we're the ones who really understand this issue. Also in Virginia, that they're just, this may be slightly unique. There isn't kind of a devoted consumer advocate in the, right, in the state office. So that's also unique. And there isn't as vocal as of let's say, a consumer advocacy outside group lobby as there might be in some other states.
Interesting. Okay, so this leads to legislation in 2015 that does what?
So it's kind of called in this sort of Frank Luntzian sort of way, the utility rate freeze legislation, which sounds like a great thing, right? No utility rate increases. But what it really did was Dominion and to some extent its kind of junior partner in this Appalachian Power knew that energy costs were going down, and they basically locked in high utility rates and then made it so, okay, we're going to freeze rates, and in exchange, until 2020 or 2021, depending on which of the two companies, the state utility regulator can't really review our rates, and as a result, can't do things like lead to proceedings on a rate reduction or give people refunds. And, you know, it's kind of complicated how a state utility regulator determines that a rate is too high, but basically they're trying to strike a balance of allowing these companies to earn enough profit to attract investment and cover their costs, but not much more. And so that's sort of the tricky thing there. And they locked in these rates to such a ridiculous degree that in a case like Appalachian, which sells electricity in West Virginia, West Virginia literally had lower rates from the same energy source and same provider from towns just across the border in Virginia. It was insanely ridiculous. And the state utility regulator, which wasn't doing comprehensive reviews, was still putting out assessments basically saying the company over-earned to the tune of between $400+ million and $1 billion. And that would entitle the average household to something like $100, $200 refund.
Wow.
If that law hadn't been in place. Folks that are experts in this told me they had never seen a utility really get away with something quite like this in a state legislature.
So if I can understand this and use this metaphor, when airline rates go up, when the cost of fuel goes through the roof. And they, the equivalent of this for Dominion and these other energy companies, are like, we'll lock in these rates. So for the next 3 or 4 years or 5 years, we will not raise our ticket prices. But of course, they're aware that the cost of engine of jet fuel is going to drop precipitously. So their profits are going to go through the roof. Under law in Virginia, regulators would have the ability to say, no, we want to maintain that same ratio essentially between your costs and your profits because you have a monopoly. So you have a regulated profit ceiling. And this 2015 law basically kept the regulators from doing that. How do regulators, if that 2015 law said that they can't be scrutinized, the energy companies, how do regulators know how much extra profit there was? Are they making estimates or what?
Well, there's some public information, of course, about their finances, and they do see forms of civil litigation. So one of the potential counterweight for some of these utilities is actually like manufacturing plants and the Navy Yard in Southeast Virginia that are huge customers of these utilities and are constantly fighting with them for more transparency. And so my understanding is that when the utility regulator in Virginia put out some of these estimates, which again aren't definitive, it was based on some of the deliberations it was handling from some of these kind of challenges it was adjudicating from industrial customers or just looking at kind of information that they did have available to them. And again, you know, that there were some estimates that the over earnings were as much as $1 billion. And again, you spread that out over 2.5 million odd electricity customers, it's like a tax cut, you know, if they were forced to actually return the money that rightly belonged to the ratepayers.
Daniel, so give me a sense of, in the course of your reporting, how savvy were lawmakers in 2015 to the fact that this was the dynamic? How much did Terry McAuliffe know in 2015 when he signed this bill? I mean, what was the idea? They thought they were getting a great deal with the rate freeze? Like, I don't even understand why that would be attractive. I don't understand why that would be attractive to lawmakers, because what difference do you care about a rate freeze if the bottom line is you know that this is heavily regulated and because of that regulation, consumers are always going to get a fair deal?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I think one of the key tension points in all of this is that the environmental groups can sometimes be bought off. And we saw that this time around, and I know that we haven't discussed the sort of efforts to repeal this rate freeze law yet, but for example, the League of Conservation Voters ended up kind of lending its support to this newer bill, which also is not good, or most people think is not good. And so I think that that's an interesting insight, because back in 2015, what Dominion and Appalachian were claiming is, well, we got this clean power plant thing. We're going to have to deal with all these new mandates. It's going to be crazy. Well, of course, you know, you and I know that natural gas has been getting cheaper than coal for years.
Right.
And all this was going to do is maybe have to accelerate that a little bit. But they were crying poverty for that reason. And so you can imagine Terry McAuliffe and some Democrats in the legislature thinking, well, you know, obviously we want to sort of meet these climate targets and everything like that. And I think that was a big piece of it. I also think that there is, and again, they, whenever they do this, they tend to make it throw in these goodies, like, or seemingly throw in goodies, like more, you know, we're gonna invest more in renewables, we're gonna modernize the grid, and we're gonna weatherize low-income people's homes. That was the case then, it's the case now, in terms of the way they kind of sell this and give Democrats permission to act on this. I also just think that there are Democrats that have been in leadership there. And frankly, it's an interesting dynamic also, because there are populists in both parties that have been challenging this consensus, and it tends to be leadership that sort of enforces the line. And I think what leadership in both parties thinks is, look, at the end of the day, the lights stay on. That's super important. And we need things to be nice and pretty and modernized and everything like that. And we're not really dealing with, you know, so if they take a little bit of an extra cut, we're not really dealing with that much. And by the way, we really need their cash to elect our candidates. And, you know, maybe looking the other way on this kind of thing outweighs the need to win elections for our other priorities. So I think it's this kind of fusion of ignorance, expedience, and other priorities.
And it also strikes me that there was a built-in assumption that this stuff is too arcane and there's really no major movement that's going to hold us to account on a vote like this. And that assumption seems to have been wrong in this era. Let's transition to that part of the story, because you made the point that
the Democrats in the summer of July, the summer of 2017, I should say, introduced what I would refer to as the marginal better deal, but the but they called it the better deal. But with that said, the rhetoric that we're seeing from the Democratic Party, and this is not, and I should say, this is not just a function of Donald Trump. There was a lot of talk about this being a movement within the Democratic Party when people thought Hillary Clinton was going to win. There's been this big antitrust push. Just talk about that from a broad perspective and then how that relates to Virginia.
Yeah, it's very interesting. At the national level, this is kind of like Democrats' new toy, at the very least, in the sense that I think the real credit goes to the Open Markets Institute and this former business reporter, Barry Lynn, who founded it first under the auspices of the New America Foundation and now independently, of basically saying, sure, Democrats are Democrats and progressives look at things like the minimum wage, they look at things like unions, they look at regulation, and they look at a host of different economic issues, increasingly the Federal Reserve, in trying to understand how we've become a country where the middle class is dwindling, where there are enormous income disparities, and where you know the kind of American dream is on life support, whatever metaphor you want to use. And Barry Lynn comes along and the Open Markets Institute and basically says, you're missing one key component of this whole thing, and that is financial concentration and the corporate consolidation that has given way to that. And what he basically has said is that, you know, aside from utilities and a handful of things, you're not going to identify an industry that is really a literal monopoly in the sense that there's only one seller of a particular product or services and that a customer doesn't literally have any other choice. But There are industries where there are one or two players that sometimes control two-thirds, three-quarters, 80, 90% of a market, and maybe sometimes have power in other sectors, so they're horizontally integrated to the point where they can dictate terms, they can effectively close off competition, they have market power that a consumer choice cannot get behind, and it effectively makes it harder for workers to get higher wages, because workers have fewer employer choices. It squeezes out small businesses in mainstream America. We know that from the Walmart effect. And it also makes that whole campaign cash problem even worse. I mean, there are a million different implications of it. People also talk about financial stability and logistics. But they really brought this onto the radar, and I think that they managed to convince Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, yep, this is a really cool issue to take up, because you don't need to be talking about drafting huge new, you don't need to just be talking about drafting huge new social programs. You can be talking about cracking down on monopolies, and it's not even an anti-business thing, because a lot of businesses are feeling the squeeze from this as well when you talk about, let's say, something like Yelp up against Google. So this is a national context in which this debate in Virginia is taking place.
And we should say, folks can go back in our archives. We've interviewed Barry Lynn, Phil Longman, Lena Khan, Matt Stoller from Open Markets over the past year, year and a half, Kay Sabeel Rahman. We have a lot of stuff on this burgeoning movement within the Democratic Party and the left. Should also say, like, even you could even see this, the rhetoric in the Gorsuch hearings. We heard this even from folks like Dianne Feinstein, who had adopted at least this notion of little guy versus the big guy. So this is something that is happening, at least on a rhetorical standpoint, in the Democratic Party. And on the ground in Virginia, it seems to have manifested itself in the actual voting behavior of some assembly members in the Virginia State House. Tell us about what happened as the specific legislation that sort of cropped up in Virginia once regulators realized, like, hey, these big energy companies here who have monopolies,
they owe consumers a bunch of money, and that 2015 legislation prevented that money from ending up in consumers' pockets.
So I think immediately after the 2017 statewide Virginia elections, which elected a new Democratic governor, Ralph Northam, in November, and really a surprising shift in the composition of the Virginia State House, the House of Delegates. So Democrats picked up a net gain of 15 seats. That was not expected at all, and it really brought a House that was under two-thirds Republican control until just about break even. In fact, Dems would have had a tie if it weren't for a straw polling gone wrong. There was a tied race that ended up resulting in the drawing of lots. And there was a consensus that regardless of who was going to be in power, this law was going to get an overhaul. But the thing is, Ralph Northam got the Democratic nomination, not his sort of progressive challenger, Tom Perriello. And Perriello had made a real issue out of the power of these utility monopolies in his race. Northam really hadn't. I just don't think it's quite on his radar in terms of, I don't know that he understands the policy in depth, quite frankly. That's an opinion. I don't know that for sure. And so they're coming in, there's big reform ideas. Now, the kind of hardcore antitrust advocates in the Virginia legislature basically just said, all right, let's just do clean repeal. And that was very quickly killed in committee. There was also a bill to ban campaign contributions from state-regulated committees, state-regulated monopolies. That was also killed in committee. And so we're very – now here's the interesting thing. So Northam did not really run against the monopolies, but these freshman Democrats did in a big way. And they did it in a big way thanks to – a Bernie Sanders campaign volunteer living in his mom's basement named Josh Stanfield. I mean, part of this was Perriello's campaign, of course, but right. Josh Stanfield created this pledge. He just said, why don't candidates for office take a pledge that they're not going to take money from Dominion or Appalachian, the two utility monopolies? And these kind of neophytes that weren't yet kind of, that didn't yet learn the, you know, the, that didn't yet have a talking to from the party brass, took the pledge en masse. And a fraction of them, 13 of them to be exact, were elected to the House of Delegates, 12 of them freshmen and one of them an incumbent. And there were many others who were...
And we should say...
Who did not take the pledge but ran against the utilities anyway.
We should say, like... Taking that pledge, and particularly if you're not like sort of immersed and bathed in the money from these companies, seems like a fairly obvious thing. Like, oh, this, we give a monopoly to this company. Of course we shouldn't take money from them because we're in charge of like their entire business practice on some level. We give them a whole lot, but we're also like, we're literally the refs in a greater fashion than in any other dynamic, perhaps in terms of like of private enterprise. Of course we shouldn't take money from them. It seems like a slam dunk, I guess. And that's why if you're a political neophyte, you're just like, yeah, I'll take that pledge. Why wouldn't I?
Right. You haven't learned the three-dimensional chess that, you know, the insiders have perfected to failure. You know, so that's kind of the political dynamic. And basically this, the bill that kind of the pro-Dominion people, most of them in the leadership of both parties, were bringing to the floor that they were calling a repeal of this rate freeze bill, had all kinds of carve outs and giveaways. And, you know, one of them I didn't even get into was that there was going to be pre-authorization for a $50 billion undergrounding of power lines project. Again, this is the sort of capital infrastructure project that the regulatory body would normally need to approve. They don't just approve rates, they approve infrastructure projects with an eye toward how they affect consumers. And this was basically saying to them, no, you don't do that anymore. We're signing off on a $50 billion price tag without any looks at the books, without, you know, a scientific forensic analysis of this. And they were also basically, they were dictating how these refunds could be calculated and how over-earnings could be calculated. And the big thing, and this is, you know, really important, was they were saying, okay, regulator, you're going to get the authority to regulate again, but you can't, and you could give refunds to consumers in over earnings years, but those refunds can be offset by investments in renewable energy infrastructure and grid modernization that, frankly, the utility probably should have been doing anyway, and they could have passed a separate bill to do. But this was kind of their get out of jail free card. I think, right, that, you know, they basically want to avoid giving money back to consumers at all costs, because you can imagine the minute they do that, they're probably looking at a minor dip in their stock price. And I think it's a power dynamic. They don't want the slippery slope. And so what critics were calling this, and were kind of incredulous about, was that this was in essence a double dip, because there was nothing in the bill that said that if Dominion or Appalachian use that refund money to invest in grid modernization and some new solar panels, that they couldn't then still go back to ratepayers and say, oh, hey, by the way, we made this improvement, and so we need to tick up the rate. You know, that there are different aspects of your utility bill, but one of them is toward fuel and toward capital expenditures. And so people were just like, well, wait a minute, that's double dipping. And in fact, Virginia's attorney general office said that's going to be double charging of the consumer. Nonetheless, Ralph Northam basically said, well, we're kind of fast tracking some renewable energy stuff, not guaranteeing it, but we're fast tracking it. And they've committed to putting $1 billion into weatherizing low income people's homes. They were claiming they had gotten more out of the negotiations than ever before. But there was this weird situation where Northam's own attorney general was saying, no, this is going to lead to double dipping. And the utility regulator had done their own independent assessment, and they said, you're going to double charge customers. Democrats in the state Senate, Democratic leadership in the state Senate there, and the Republican leadership there passed the bill. It was by a closer margin than the rate freeze bill had been, but they passed it on a bipartisan basis, and there was a bipartisan group of dissenters, and that was last Friday. And so this then brings us to kind of the climactic and unexpected moment that you sort of hinted at and previewed on Monday. And I can get into that if you want me to continue.
Yeah, I just want to it passes the Senate. You're writing your piece. The nature of your piece, it's a great piece. And it really, I think, shows a fascinating dynamic. But you're writing this piece as like, look, the Democrats have an opportunity here. They haven't quite matured into it. But this is a good example of where they could in the future exercise, you know, sort of like actually put some teeth behind this rhetoric. This would have been a great opportunity. It's probably going to pass in the House in a day or two, and because it just passed in the Senate, but it came close and closer than it's been in the past. So it shows some type of progression. And then what happens?
So I got there on Monday, and they're, you know, I'm talking to individual members, and they're starting to read my piece and get a sense of it. And really, my thinking, I had started on this, I had the germ in my head of this piece from the moment of November when the election results came in. I said, this is going to be a big dynamic. But so my attitude was Monday, basically, I'm just going to get color and put a face to a name in some case of people that I had met. And I had met some lawmakers on Friday, too. But I didn't think that there was really going to be news. I thought I was going to get some color for a story that this had passed the Senate. It was largely going to pass the House unamended. They're moving towards an awareness on this, just as you said it, but they're not quite there yet. And late in the, you know, really in the evening, because again, in these 3-month sessions, they pack in sometimes 12, 15 hour days to just go through marathons of different bills. I see that they're discussing an amendment that would have explicitly barred this double dipping practice, this idea that if the utility uses the refund money toward a capital investment, it can't then go back and charge the ratepayer again through the normal utility bill. And the Democratic House Minority Leader, David Toscano from Charlottesville, who had voted this bill unamended out of committee, introduced this amendment to bar double charging that had been voted down in the Senate. And he basically got up there and just said, and just called their bluff. And he said, look, if you guys say, trust us, there's no double dipping in this, then what would the harm be in adding a little provision to this bill that explicitly says that? And, you know, right, it's sort of ridiculous. And then the guy that introduced it, you know, the Republican that introduced the unamended bill was sort of like we saw
this dynamic with net neutrality, right? Like where the day before Ajit Pai is going to reverse net neutrality, you've got like at Verizon coming out saying like, hey, don't worry, we're definitely not going to do what this bill allows us to do. We would never do it, so we don't need to be prohibited from doing it. Like, I mean, it's one of those jobbies, but go ahead.
Totally, like circular logic, you know, just put it in writing, guys.
Right,
know?
Exactly.
Generally, if a corporation, let alone a monopoly, says, just trust us, you might not want to do that. And that was some of what we were hearing on the House floor, too, is people were saying, hey, guys, remember 2015? And before that, there was, I mean, the history of this goes way back further than even 2015 and the broken promises and everything. And anytime they look like they're about to get regulated, they sort of move the goalposts. But behind the scenes, the Democratic caucus had kind of come to an understanding earlier in the day that they needed to force this as an issue. And they apparently had really heard from the grassroots, including folks associated with Tom Perriello's new group, but also just a lot of these upstart indivisible type groups and this group called Network Nova. And people were just furious about the double dipping, and they were burning up the phone lines, burning up the emails. The Democratic House Minority Leader did a Survey Monkey study of his constituents, kind of hokey, but, you know, definitely honorable in a certain sort of way. And I guess to their surprise, the Democratic caucus remained entirely united. So all 49 of them, and then six Republicans joined them. And you could just see there on the floor that the Republican Speaker of the House of Delegates was like, wait a minute, what's going on? And so the Republicans then said, well, you know, hold on a second. We don't want voters to think that we oppose this on principle. We just didn't want to change the law on the fly. So reopen a vote and we'll all vote for this unanimously, which was kind of hilarious to watch. And they did a voice vote and every Republican voted for it. Subsequently, the amended bill passed the House on Tuesday. There are still plenty of things that critics rightly object to in the bill, including this kind of outrageous price tag that will be exempted from oversight on you know, the undergrounding of these power lines. There's the fact that there are all sorts of projects that the regulatory body will also have to approve. The fact that the new solar infrastructure basically has to be, and wind infrastructure is basically going to have to be created by these utility monopolies who kind of claim they're doing everybody a favor by going green. But these are things that could have been opened up to competitive bidding. I mean, the monopoly piece of this is really in the selling and the distributing of the electricity, not in the kind of harvesting of the energy itself. But that's kind of the price of doing business with these monopolies. And so this was just a really unusual moment. And I think for people that felt like this needed to, that wonder whether their activism matters, this was a demonstration that it does. Of course, the fight's not over. There's going to be a conference committee bill, and they're still going to try and strip it. And there's going to be all kinds of, you know, they have all kinds of weasel words that they throw in there to massage this and try to make it seem like the bad thing that they're doing is really a good thing. So it's something to continue to watch, but it's a really interesting illustration of elections having consequences. I think Northam probably is thinking that he spoke too soon.
Yeah.
And that's an interesting dynamic. So I think it's just a really interesting test case for progressives to look at.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me for all those reasons. And it also suggests that these groups that have been set up that presumably are focused on elections, you know, they're sitting there with they they ostensibly may have created these entities for elections, but, you know, they've created organizations of activists who then have an infrastructure that they can begin to apply to legislative fights like this one. And that's incredibly encouraging.
Yeah, it's sort of an unintended consequence. And I think that there are certainly figures in the Democratic leadership and establishment that may have gotten more than they bargained for and really liked these indivisible groups when they were helping elect Democrats against Republicans and are kind of maybe wondering, what was this monster we let out of the bag? But I think, you know, to the credit of a guy like Democratic leader Toscano, he's willing to kind of move on this stuff. And he actually ended up voting against the final bill as well, despite, you know, many members of his caucus supporting it. I mean, the bill ended up passing like something like 2/3 to 1/3 with the amendment, which is important, but it still had all kinds of garbage stuff in it. And so, you know, that was interesting. You know, I mean, there are some versions of establishment Democrats that will fight to the last tooth against accountability from the grassroots. And there are others who say, okay, all right, I get it. You guys care about this stuff. I don't necessarily totally get it from a policy perspective, or maybe I'm just craving about it, but I'm willing to go along with this for political reasons. And that's really interesting. I also just think that the freshman class there, I mean, there could just be a story written about it alone. They're incredibly fresh. A lot of them are millennials. It's super diverse. It's the first lesbian lawmaker in Dawn Adams. The first two Latina lawmakers, including the first Latina immigrant lawmaker in Elizabeth Guzman, the first open Democratic Socialist and DSA member in Lee Carter. You know, there's Chris Hurst, who was inspired to run after his girlfriend got blown away on live television. And, you know, so there's just, it's a really interesting test case. I found it fascinating being down there too, because, I mean, Congress, you get a ton of access, but at the state legislature level, you get a ton of access and you're competing with like four other people for interviews in the sense of other reporters.
Right.
You know, the scrum on Capitol Hill looks a lot different. And so, I really encourage my fellow reporters and citizen journalists to check out what's going on. I mean, I know you guys are based in New York, Albany. Boy, that place must be a mess. So
total.
It's an interesting way to look at a national issue.
Daniel Marins, the piece is on what battle, a battle over Virginia's most powerful monopoly can teach Democrats everywhere. And, of course, there was a follow-up piece following the actual vote. People can check it out at HuffPost. We will link to it at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Sam.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. Going to head into the fun half. I'm glad we heard that story. It's an important piece. Obviously, everybody is thinking about what took place at that high school yesterday. And, you know, the more than likely inaction by our Congress. But I think it's also important to not accept that level of inaction. You know, it may just be a situation like we just saw in Virginia, where you have some intractable issues with a tremendous amount of financial support behind it that is dominating this question. I mean, the reality is, too, is that, you know, we've said this before. For people who want to have access to AR-15s, it apparently is their number one issue. For people who don't want there to be a proliferation of military-style weapons in our society, it is not a number one issue for the most part. That's just, I'm just talking about what polling says. So that type of the depth of this issue is different on the two different sides.
Yeah, when I was working.
Oh, hold on. Good.
When I was working at Fusion, I worked on this.
This is Brendan, everyone.
Hi, yes. Folks. We did this thing called like breaking bread, and it was like people of opposing sides sitting at a table to like hash out issues. And one of the ones, the last ones we did was Newtown. And we went up there, and there were like gun supporters from that area and like people who worked for every town and like have dedicated their lives to ending this. And those are the most dedicated people to ending gun violence that probably writ large in the country. And the craziest thing, I'll never forget it, was this gun rights advocate saying, when he said, every time there's a mass shooting, I immediately open my computer and I donate to the NRA. And I will never shake that. And like that's what we're up against, really. And to say the least, like those people did not reconcile their differences at that meal breaking bread.
I mean, I think, you know, the only upside is that there's less of those people than there are of us. And it just has to be, I mean, you know, the fact that those Democrats and DSA members and whatnot got elected in Virginia made this possible. Well, it didn't perfect, not, you know, it's not a done deal, but the point is that story we just heard, elections do have consequences. That's the way, at least in, you know, today, that change happens. And then these organizations that are growing up around ostensibly for elections are there and activated, and you have activists who are pushing. And this is the part that I feel like people on the left largely go to sleep on, you know, ranging from the center to through the left, is there's too much of a notion of like, well, we elected the person that we wanted to elect. Now we can go back to sleep until 3.5 years from now. And the reality is that the lawmaking process is ultimately far more important. That pressure is applied during that time.
Yeah, that's also how people get elected that you want in the first place. I also think you talked a bit about sort of the need to shame the CEOs of the gun companies, and I don't think that's a bad idea, but also this is so systemic. Like, as long as there is money to be made doing this with no consequences, someone is going to do it. That's just how capitalism works. So we need to set it up so that this is materially disincentivized. Otherwise, nothing's going to change.
That was, and frankly, that was one of the biggest issues I had with Bernie's record on guns, was that vote that gave special immunity to gun manufacturers. That, to me, very problematic, because one of the way that we inhibit profits when we have this type of intractable political situation is to sick the tort lawyers on them and make it super expensive for them to maintain a certain practice. So, you know, in a less than perfect world, but a slightly better one than this, you know, my buddy Mike Papantonio is suing multiple gun manufacturers for not, you know, putting child, you know, fingerprint locks on it, for not having massive insurance policies as to, you know, having to pay off when something like this happens, when the gun is used in the way that it was meant to be used, but ends up, you know, in those instances, gun manufacturers will find a way to, you know, inhibit the purchase of their things so that it would cost them less down the road. But all right, we're going to take a break, head into the fun half. For those of you who just enjoy the first half of this program, this is our final live show of the day. Of course, that will make a difference for you if you listen to this podcast, which far thousands upon thousands of you do more than listen live. So I don't know why, like that. I don't know why I have that. What is it, Matt? Why do I always have that? It's a podcast, for God's sake, for the vast majority of people.
But there's something special about sharing a moment in time as it happens with people.
It's very sweet of you to say. We have great interviews over the next week. Great interviews for you. So enjoy it. Also, during that week, I always, almost always forget to, we have some great interviews, and I always forget to say, become a member, support the show. So if you listen to this program on a semi-regular basis and you have the financial means, please become a member. You can go to jointhemajorityreport.com. It is your support that makes this show possible. And as a way of saying thank you, we give you some extra content every day when we call it the Fun Half. And then you also get to search the archives much easier. And so jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, over the break, check out Jamie's Patreon page for her latest posts. Patreon.com/JamiePeck.
Yeah, let me know if there's anything you guys want me to address on there, guys. That's it's. I want it to be interactive.
There's this whole new interactive thing with the web now. Also, don't forget TMBS, available on our YouTube channel. Check out, go back into our videos. If you miss us, go back. The fun thing for people always do, go check out our Libertarian Debate playlist. Some of our greatest hits.
I just watched the one with Daryl yesterday, presidential candidate Daryl. That's what I was doing, laughing on the couch.
There you go.
Amazing. Your composure was the most amazing part.
That was amazing. That was.
Those were better days.
Those were better days. It's true. But they'll return. Believe me, they'll return. As soon as Republicans get out of power, the libertarians all sort of come back up, right? Because we've got to figure out how we can sound reasonable again. All right, quick break, 646-257-3920. We'll be right back.